About impenitence. Well aware of how offensive I make myself, and with what loathing I may well be regarded, in this sentimental age which pretends to be cynical, and in this poetical nation which pretends to be practical, I shall, nevertheless, continue to practice in public a very repulsive trick or habit, the habit of drawing distinctions, or distinguishing between things that are quite different, even when they are assumed to be the same. I cannot be content with being a unionist, or a universalist, or a unitarian. I have again and again blasphemed against and denied the perfect oneness of chalk and cheese, and drawn fanciful distinctions, ornithological or technological, between hawks and handsaws. For in truth, I believe that the only way to say anything definite is to define it, and all definition is by limitation and exclusion. And that the only way to say something distinct is to say something distinguishable, and distinguishable from everything else. In short, I think that a man does not know what he is saying until he knows what he is not saying. At this moment, if we were to judge by a general direction, by a vague unanimity existing in very varying degrees, and consisting of opinions rather similar but not the same, we should certainly say that there was a universal wave of pacifism, just as in 1914 there was a general wave of patriotism. And when I say pacifism, I do not mean peace. It is possible, as I happen to know, to think pacifism a very direct menace to peace, but I am not debating these political points here. My thesis here is made up of very varied materials, and also of distinctly different views. Now, whatever we may think of these views, regarded as general political views, it will be well to pick out of them certain really preposterous propositions, as one would weed a patch of soil. Neither side of any controversy can be the better for mere confusion and delusion, still less for the confusion of one delusion with another, or of a delusion with a defensible opinion. There are many forms of pacifism which are quite defensible opinions, though I personally might be more inclined to attack than to defend them. There are any number of forms of peace policy which I should profoundly respect, and some with which I entirely agree. But one or two fancies have begun to form in the chaos, which are simply fragments of fixed and frozen nonsense. I have explained that I believe in drawing distinctions, or what is called splitting hairs. I do not believe in saying breezily that a fungus is pretty much the same as a fungoid, even if you are hungry and in a hurry to have mushrooms for breakfast, or agreeing heartily that a rhombus is the same as a rhomboid, because you have to hustle the geometricians in some plans for housing or surveying. I think the first sort of practicality will probably end with a number of people being poisoned with toadstools, or worse, and the latter with ungeometrical houses falling down on ungeometrical, though practical, men of action. And I wish to point out that you cannot conduct a policy of pacifism, or of anything else, unless you will consent to distinguish one idea from another, and to find out where your own ideas came from, and with what other ideas they conflict. This weeding of the weaker or wilder ideas out of the mind is simply a practical piece of gardening which applies to any sort of garden, even the garden of peace, even to a garden planted with nothing but olives and undefiled with a single leaf of the laurel. For instance, there is a wild hypothesis now hardening in the minds of many which has nothing to do with any philosophical case of pacifism, let alone peace. It is the notion that not fighting, as such, would prevent somebody else from fighting, or from taking all he wanted without fighting. It assumes that every pacifist is some strange blend of a lion tamer and a mesmerist, who would hold up invading armies with his glittering eye like the Ancient Mariner. The pacifist would paralyze the militarist in all his actions, both militant and post-militant. Now, there is no sort of sense or even meaning in this notion at all. It is a muddle and mixture of a number of other and older Pacific traditions, all of them much more reasonable, and some of them quite right. Some of them are the ancient attitudes of the saint or sage towards all sorts of misfortune. Some of them are more or less mystical experiments in psychology suitable to exceptional cases. Some of them are mere dregs of dramatic and romantic situations out of particular plays, novels, or short stories. There have been many great and good men in the past who have said that they would never need to resist spoliation or invasion, or would not care if it were irresistible. But they were almost always one of two types, and they were thinking only of one or two truths. In some of them it meant, "My mind to me a kingdom is. The inner life is so deep and precious that I do not care if I am beggared or made an outlaw or even a slave." In others it meant, "I know that my Avenger liveth. The judgment of this world may beggar or enslave me, but I shall have justice when I appeal to a higher court." Both these moral attitudes mean something, and something worthy of all possible respect. But neither of these two types was ever such a fool as to say that he could not be beggared or enslaved, merely because he stood stock still like a post and did not resist beggary or enslavement. Neither of them was so silly as to suppose that there were not men in the world, wicked or resolute or fanatical or mechanically servile enough, to do unpleasant things to them, while they were content to do nothing. The Stoic claimed to endure pain with patience, but he never claimed that his patience would prevent anybody from causing him pain. The martyr endured tortures to assert his belief in truth, but he never asserted his disbelief in torture. The hazy notion that has been gathering more and more substance in the modern mind is quite different and is really unreasonable. Men who have no intention of abandoning their country's wealth, not to mention their own, men who rightly insist on comfort for their countrymen, and not infrequently for themselves, still seem to have formed a strange idea that they can keep all these things in all conceivable circumstances, solely and entirely by refusing to defend them. They seem to fancy they could bring the whole reign of violence and pride to an end, instantly and entirely, merely by doing nothing. Now, it is not easy to do anything by doing nothing. Oddly enough, the only exceptional hint of truth in this theory of establishing peace is the same notion which made rude barbaric groups sometimes establish trial by battle. It was the notion that, under some very vivid and awful conditions, the man who knew he was in the wrong might lose his nerve. There was a story about that wicked man, Godwin, the father of Harold, which illustrates the idea, and Scott used it as a dramatic turn in the death of the Templar. It did occasionally happen then. It might just conceivably happen now. But it happened because everybody believed in God, everybody thought the same about perjury and blasphemy, and a theory of justice was common to those who vindicated and those who violated it. In the present utter severance of fundamental ideas, I cannot see why this exceptional trick should work at all. The pacifists are only a sect, and Europe is boiling over with equally sincere militarist and imperialist sects. Does anybody believe that Hitler or Stalin or Mussolini would ruin all his plans because a Quaker did not propose to interfere with them?